This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to a week of myths and legends. These are conversations with people talking about the old stories that reach back into the dim, dark past and that sometimes resurface as children's tales or as horror stories or tales of gods and monsters and even, in one case, a superhero. The fact that these myths are still with us tells us something about what we secretly long for and what we dread in the pits of our stomachs. The first guest today is English novelist Sarah Perry. In Sarah's most recent novel, she created a monster called Melmoth. Melmoth is her version of a distinctive character who goes back all the way to the Dark Ages. In Sarah's book, her main character comes into possession of a manuscript that's full of terrible stories from some of the darkest episodes in human history. And each one of these tales records the arrival of a tall, silent woman in black with floating hair. Her name is Melmoth, and she's forced to walk the world with bleeding feet. She knows all the bad things that you've done, and she wants you to keep her company, because who else would want you after the terrible thing that you did? I spoke with Sarah Perry last year. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
How long have you wanted to write a great monster story?
About 30 years, I think. I remember when I was very young feeling quite incensed that there were no great female monsters in particular. So I was a very voracious reader very young. I read Dracula when I was about 12, I think, and Frankenstein soon after. I read a prose translation of the Odyssey, which contains monsters but has a sort of male titular hero. And I remember being genuinely incensed that there were no eponymous female monsters.
Well, there's Medusa. I mean, yes.
But not like an entire saga dedicated to Medusa. So one finds interesting witches and female monsters, but they don't tend to carry the narrative, historically haven't carried the narrative in the same way. And I remember being, as an arrogant child, thinking one day I shall create a monster and she shall be female.
How about Frankenstein's monster? What's the most monstrous thing about that creature or the story for you?
You know, a long time ago at an event, I did what seemed to be a slip of the tongue and referred to Frankenstein as being the monster. And a lady came up to me in the queue and she said, I'm really sorry to correct you, but Frankenstein was not the monster. It was the creature that was the monster. And I said, I'm afraid not.
No.
The real monster is the doctor whose hubris and arrogance caused him to create an innocent being and damn him to a life without love and without hope. And the amazing thing about Frankenstein is that it effectively kind of kills God. It kills the idea of us being born in original sin and sort of part of kind of God's plan, and proposes the idea that you can be born totally innocent with nothing in you that is malicious or spiteful or angry, and that it's your contact with the rest of us that degrades you and turns you into a monster. So the great thing about Frankenstein is that the creature isn't the monster, it's the man who made him.
I think the thing about monstrous creatures that are male, the threat they give you is one of like terrible physical violence. That's the thing. But I think the female monsters are the ghosts, like the woman in black.
Yeah.
And the terror in them comes from their hate and rage. What do you think of that?
I think that's true. And I think that it comes from kind of places of great injustice often, specifically with the woman in black. I can't remember the exact details, but I remember that she was a woman who had been hard done by. And that was the really big challenge for me with Melmoth, was this feeling that it wasn't enough merely to make her pronouns female and to give her a dress. There had to be something intrinsically of the female experience about what had happened to her, both about her institutionary curse that created her and about the way she appears to people. So she has this combination of being deeply seductive and vulnerable, but also absolutely terrifying and malicious. And those two things seem to me to kind of go against what you're saying is that, you know, the very male version of a hero, which is that they might rip you limb from limb on an ice floe somewhere.
Melmoth, the character, was once male. Tell me how you found the origins of Melmoth and how you changed that into this female monster.
Sure. So a few years ago, I was doing a PhD in the Gothic, and my PhD supervisor said to me, "I'm terribly sorry, Sarah, but you're going to have to read Melmoth the Wanderer." And I remember thinking, oh no, really? So Melmoth the Wanderer is a novel that was published in 1820, and it's written by an impoverished Irish vicar called Charles Robert Maturin. And he wrote to his friend Walter Scott and said, "I'm going to write a novel so horrendous, it will out-Herod all the Herods." And he succeeded. So he wrote a novel about a man who sold his soul to the devil for an extra 150 years on earth. And he swiftly realises this is a terrible idea, and he tries to persuade people to exchange places with him.
What person would want to exchange places?
This is exactly the pertinent point. Only people in such a desperate state of despair and misery that transaction is a better bargain. So Melmoth visits people tortured by the Spanish Inquisition, holed up in terrible institutions of madness and despair, women who have lost all of their children, their entire family in a house fire, and are completely without any hope of salvation or happiness. And so it's a really traumatic book, visiting some of the darkest periods of history. And that is inspired by the same things that inspire Faust and so on,
yes,
which is just the legend of the wandering Jew, which is an anti-Semitic legend of a Jew who's kind of cursed to wander the earth until Christ comes back. And as soon as I read this book, which is about 7 or 8 years ago now, I thought, God, what I want to do is to write a contemporary set version of Melmoth and make my Melmoth a woman, turn that monster into a woman, and use that structure of visiting horrific places, but do it in a different way, give it a different purpose and a different kind of moral feeling.
Melmoth tries to offer a kind of comfort to her victims. Is that an important distinction there, do you think?
I think so, because what I needed was for it to be psychologically plausible that one might go away with Melmoth. So Melmoth comes to people who are crippled by guilt, or even like not quite crippled by it because they haven't realised what they've done. And she shows them the consequences of their actions in a very visceral way. And then she says to them, "I'm the only person who knows what you've done. I've seen it all. I know everything about how awful you are. If everybody else knew, they wouldn't want you, but I do. So you come away with me." And so she needs to offer them comfort, because otherwise why would you go? But the comfort is very thin, because she's just trying to show them that there's no hope.
So the legend of your Melmoth is that she wanders the earth. What condemns her to wander the earth?
I had great fun with this. So I invented an origin story, which is that Melmoth was one of the company of women that saw the risen Christ after visiting his tomb and denied that she ever saw him. When she questioned, she said, "No, I saw nothing." And because of that, her curse is to bear witness. She had failed to bear witness. She'd failed to tell the truth about what she'd seen. So she's cursed for the rest of her life to wander the earth bearing witness to terrible things.
So what's her sin there? Is it lying, or is it cynicism or skepticism?
I think at heart, what the curse was issued for was because, in inverted commas, she lied. But my purpose in creating that origin story is to strike at the heart of femaleness, to create something very female about her curse. Now, the women who did tell the men that they had seen Christ, nobody believed them. They weren't believed. So the reason Melmoth originally said she hadn't seen him was because she knew what happens when women say what they've seen. They're not believed by the men. So her curse is very pitiable. She's been cursed for something which wasn't really a sin. It was more a sort of act of self-preservation. So it was always very important to me that she should be kind of compromised in the reader's mind, that you would always feel pity alongside the terror. Because that's kind of at the heart of the Gothic, is sympathy for the devil, basically.
This monster makes her victims bear witness to terrible crimes. What was your thinking behind that? Why did you want to have that?
I remember coming to the end of the sort of promotional stuff for The Essex Serpent, my second novel, and the world seemed to be sort of burning around our ears slightly. So this was back in 2016. The refugee crisis from Syria was at a real height in Europe. So we would see on Twitter and on Facebook uninvited photos of drowned Syrian toddlers washing up on beaches. There'd been the massacre in the Orlando nightclub when 52 members of the LGBT community were murdered because of who they were. ISIS was sort of rampaging across the Middle East, hurling people from buildings, and I wanted to give up writing.
Why?
It seemed to me to be fiddling while Rome burned. The Essex Serpent had been such joy to write and had given me so much pleasure, and I felt that I had a sort of respectable intellect that could have been put to good use, working in law, working in medicine. And what had I chosen to do? Entertain people. And it seemed a very sort of feeble and morally compromised thing to do in the context. So I decided...
Really? That you really thought that?
Really.
You didn't put any moral worth into giving people pleasure?
No. Well, I'm not sure I did at the time. I believe it now. But I entered this very strange feeling of despair that I wasn't intervening in what was happening in the world. So the reason Melmoth bears witness, and the reason this book is about bearing witness, is because I came to understand that bearing witness is an act of moral courage, and that even those of us who can't intervene when we see things happening around us, you still have a choice to see what's happening and to act with moral courage where you can, even in the sort of small day-to-day decisions in our lives. So Melmoth constitutes a kind of act on my part to persuade myself that novels can have kind of moral purpose, and that they do deserve to be read at the time that we live in, and that you can use entertaining fiction, because I hope Melmoth is also a page turner and creepy and fun, and that that reading pleasure can sit alongside a kind of response to the way we live now.
It's not enough for a novel to sort of show us more about what people are like. You really want to do good in the world with a novel? That's a really Protestant thought.
I can't escape it. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I know this is a really old-fashioned thing to say, but I do not think that when you sit down to create art that all of your kind of moral impulses and your beliefs about the world turn off like a tap and then you become an artist and you create something. Everything that you believe to have purpose and value in life should continue and kind of extend into your work, because your work is a sort of extension of yourself. And so for me, a desire to have moral value in my kind of existence and a kind of active moral purpose wouldn't stop because I'm just writing a novel. It has to be a continuation of kind of what I believe. I never left Sunday school, did I? It's terrible.
See, I come from way back from a comedy background. And one of the exercises you do in comedy is to say the worst thing that's in the back of your mind.
Really?
And just put it in front of everyone so everyone can laugh and how monstrous it is.
Yeah.
Have you ever done that?
Yes. I feel like moral courage also consists in doing that and having the courage to reveal yourself to be deeply flawed and deeply failed and to not attempt to lie about it. And so, in all of my books, I've offered transgressive sexual relationships. I've offered compromised moral positions. I've sort of challenged people to think about, you think this is good? You think that's how you would behave? I'm not so sure. So it's not about a kind of preachy didacticism or, God help us all, only writing books which are a kind of, you know, like mid-Victorian morality pamphlet. Mm. It's about having a kind of view of human behaviour which is simultaneously very clear-eyed and very kind of pitiless, but also quite compassionate, because, you know, we all try, we all fail, that's fine, we can write about all of these things.
Melmoth, she doesn't come to Stalin, she doesn't come to Hitler, she doesn't come to Oliver Cromwell, she comes to quite ordinary people. What's your thinking behind that?
I think that we are in a very dangerous position now where we think that monsters have hooves and horns. So I think that we are exculpating ourselves from a kind of collective responsibility for where we are and what's happening to us. The unpalatable truth is the great atrocities of the world have been carried out by functionaries who are perfectly ordinary people in suits and ties who went off to the office in Berlin in 1941 and rubber stamped a document without actually thinking about what they were doing. I went to a lecture recently on doctors in the Third Reich, and amongst the medical profession was the highest Nazi party membership. And when you see those photos of people in Auschwitz being divided into labour or death, it was doctors with a stethoscope that was doing the division of the people.
Hmm. So much for the idea that an education makes you a better person or more virtuous person than an uneducated person.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think knowledge is a really important one thing, but that's very separate from education.
Yes,
and
it can
be kind of weaponized.
When a bunch of people do a terrible thing and you say, what people need is education. You go, maybe they'll just have better scalpels and better weapons if they have the education. Yeah.
So I chose my villains very carefully because I needed them to be people as boring as you and I, you know. and I needed them to be I needed them to be fairly ordinary people. Because all of us, none of us are ordinary, we're all capable of acts of enormous kind of moral failure and transgression and potentially of violence. And the thing that divides you and me and, you know, the perfectly nice and polite people around us from horrible things isn't that we are intrinsically better than the people who do those things, but, you know, perhaps the situation hasn't arisen, or the long accumulation of normalisation and cowardice that leads up to things like the Armenian Genocide. So I don't want anyone to read this book and come away from it thinking that they know who the bad people are, and it's definitely not them.
Your main character, Helen, in this story is someone who's quite a drab person. You've made her out to be very, very drab. She lives in Prague, even though she's English. And finally, without saying too much, when she gives away the terrible sin that she's felt such crushing shame over for many, many years, for more than 20 years, the old lady she's with goes, pfft. She says, that's it. She says, oh, this man you sort of screwed over, he gave you a life and you've made a prison out of it. Yeah. I've kind of read that and went, well, that's kind of true, is it? It seems like you're calling for shame. And is there eternal shame? Is there any point to shame? Or is that just pure self-indulgence in some level?
I think that the kind of shame that she experiences, which is this self-lacerating, hopeless, self-flagellating thing, is a function of our inability to understand the concept of forgiveness, both of ourselves and of other people. And I think, I call myself post-religious now. I don't worship regularly anywhere, but I'm obviously, as you've pointed out, very, very influenced by Christian theology. And I've always felt that the doctrine of original sin, unpleasant as it is, has a kernel of benevolence in it, right? Because if you believe that all of us are equally capable of doing terrible things or mildly bad things, we are also all equally able to access grace and forgiveness and the ability to just have it wiped away and start again. And what Helen's lost is that. She doesn't have the concept that whatever she did, she can be forgiven for it. She can forgive herself for it, and she can begin again, and she can live a life which is redemptive in the sense of its pursuit of something whole and something sort of nourishing. So what Melmoth does is to try to trade on that, and she tries to say to people, there's no hope, you'll never be forgiven. And if they give in, and if they accept that there's no hope, then they will never find it. So it's a challenge to kind of set shame aside, I think. And the weird thing is, you don't escape shame by insisting you did nothing wrong. The only way you escape it is by saying, I did, I failed, I'm really sorry, everybody. I hope you forgive me. I need to forgive myself. I will make some form of restitution if need be, and then I will continue and move on.
I can't help thinking, as I've been talking to you and as I was reading the book, that there is that strong strain of quite English Protestantism through it. Is that the household you grew up in?
It is, yeah. I was. I often joke I was born in about 1890. So
you're looking well.
Yeah, I bathe in the blood of virgins. That's not a very Protestant thing to say, I apologise. So I was brought up in a strict Baptist sect, and I use the word sect very carefully because it wasn't a cult, and I've always been very careful to make sure people don't misunderstand it as being a sort of unpleasant or violent community that you would be expelled from if you left. It wasn't like that, but it was like being brought up in the 19th century. So we had no access to popular culture. I didn't wear trousers. We had no television, no pop music, didn't go to the cinema or parties or school discos or anything like that. And also it was very, very firmly embedded in Protestant theology and Protestant history and in the King James Bible. So from a very early age, I was familiar, deeply familiar with these massive ideas about culpability and forgiveness and so on. And as somebody who is now very much in a sort of post-religious state and no longer, certainly no longer a strict Baptist and rarely actually attends church, to the horror of my parents, I'm nonetheless still very much enthralled to those ideas because I think they bear scrutiny, the idea that we are equal in our capacity for both amazing things and terrible things and equal in our ability to access kind of forgiveness.
You said you were denied all those things like, you know, pop culture and listening to Oasis or whatever it was that was going around at the time. Did you mind at the time?
I occasionally minded, but I only ever minded when I was reminded of it, if you see what I mean. Left to my own devices, to this day, and certainly when I was 13, all I really wanted to do was sit on my bed, do terrible watercolour copies of Pre-Raphaelite paintings, and then read some Tennyson.
They went too Protestant, those Pre-Raphaelites.
Yeah, yeah, no, I know. No. I had posters of them on my wall, and my granny got me to take them down because the ladies didn't have any tops on. And so I was very, very happy with being surrounded by classical literature, classical music. All of this stuff is incredibly nourishing. And then occasionally someone would mention a band that I'd never heard of, and I'd feel a bit grumpy and wish that, you know, I was a little bit more normal. But
did you, in all honesty, did you sort of hold yourself apart a little bit from people around you as being a little bit more virtuous and better than them, and you're looking back?
I think I possibly did, but never out of a feeling of intrinsic worth, but because the nature of a sect is that they identify behaviour which marks you out as having done things properly. This is sort of what a sect is, lots of rules and regulations. So I have a really sad memory from my childhood, really sad, which is that a girl in my class became a Christian and gave her testimony. And that's an incredibly brave thing for a 13 or 14-year-old to do at just a school in Essex, was to say to the teacher, there's something I want to tell everyone in the class. And she stood up and she explained that she'd become a Christian. And she was wearing jeans. And I actually remember thinking, you can't be a Christian, you're wearing jeans. And I went home and told my mum. And I said to my mum, Brenda, for such was her name, says she's become a Christian, but she was wearing jeans, so she can't be. And my mother dropped the potato she was peeling. And she said, what on earth makes you think that you can't be a Christian and wear jeans? And I went, you? Because you brought me up to believe that women can't wear trousers. And I think it was a really interesting moment where she was confronted with what happens when you bring a child up to think these things, you know. And she said to me, no, you don't understand. So there were these strange moments of your mind being trained to go, well, we know what a good Christian does, and I assure you they wear skirts.
How real was the devil?
Very real.
A person? Yeah. Was it like a figure, or was it a force, or how did you picture
it? They very rarely talked in sort of supernatural terms. The thing about Protestant theology is that obviously it's supernatural. You're talking about three persons in the one Godhead and a literal heaven and hell. But also it's very logical. So our forms of worship were very unemotional. The preaching was very intellectual. It would always be down to kind of the words and the language in the scripture. So although we had the idea of a real devil, nobody would ever preach or talk about it as being a kind of creature that might come into the room. But it was very present. And the thing where it was most present would be if you read the Bible and you didn't believe it, that was the devil tempting you. And you had to pray that the devil would be taken away and that you would be able to believe what you're reading. And that's incredibly pernicious and incredibly dangerous, because what it's telling a child or an older person is that their own intellect and their own reason is devilish, and that they have to completely subjugate it to this kind of literal interpretation of scripture. And, you know, if you were occasionally, if somebody was depressed, that was, you know, the devil's really attacking them. The devil's attacking them. You're like, maybe they need some sertraline.
Talking to people who grow up in very intensely Catholic childhoods, one thing they often have in common is this: they had the idea that they had a soul, but the soul was almost like a physical organ inside of them, like a heart. Did you have that sort of an idea of what your soul was?
No, that would be more a kind of just the idea of a spirit, of an eternal spirit. And we were very much focused on the idea of the resurrection. And I'm actually writing a little bit about my youth and childhood now for my next novel. And one of the things that was very striking is that funerals weren't sad, and that it would actually be slightly bad form to be too upset at a funeral, because after all, they hadn't died. They'd gone home. They'd gone to glory. And to mourn would be selfish, because you're only mourning because that you're missing them. You're not crying for them. You're crying for yourself, which is a little self-indulgent and sinful. So the idea of an immortal soul outliving the body was very, very strong.
In your 20s, you went to live in the Philippines. You got married, your husband, and you went to the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Was that for religious work?
Yes. Yeah. So we were working for a Christian charity that had homes for street children. I haven't been back to Manila, but in 2001, 2002, it was very poor. And there was a lot of... they had that revolution, that incredible bloodless revolution.
Cory Aquino, mid-80s.
Yeah, amazing what they achieved. And after that, as part of their constitution... anybody could make a home on government land, you know, as a way of making sure that people could be housed, which means that Manila has these huge squatter communities, which are basically shanty towns on land. Those are not always great places for children. And so there'd be lots and lots of deeply abused or homeless, abandoned children. And so we worked for an orphanage that looked after some of these girls, but with a very, very Christian bent. So, you know, they all went to church and Sunday school, and so it was kind of a combination of aid work and mission work in some ways.
How did you handle what you saw there? I mean, there's proper poverty in the Philippines. Not that it doesn't exist in Britain, but it's a whole other order in the Philippines.
There is a scene that I will never forget where in time we became used to the shanty towns, the sort of tin shacks, which were very scrupulously clean, smelt of washing powder. Often they'd all club together to buy a jukebox because Filipinos are great singers. They say that they invented the karaoke machine, and the children would all troop out of these shanty towns in beautifully pressed uniforms, laundered and pressed uniforms, go off to school and come back. And we became used to that. Then after that, I became used to seeing the homeless people, and they would have several cardboard boxes and like a little candle sometimes if they were living in a dark space. And then one day we were walking home, and under Aurora Bridge, Aurora Boulevard is a huge elevated sort of multi-lane road, under the bridge there was a woman and her three children, and they didn't even have a cardboard box to sit on. And for the rest of my life, that will define the most abject poverty I've ever seen, which is that they didn't have a cardboard box to sit on, a flattened piece of cardboard, and her children were just in vests. They had nothing on underneath, and she was just in a vest. And of course we went to the shops and we bought nappies and baby food and all sorts of things and gave them to her, but the idea that you could be that poor and that desperate was quite extraordinary to me. And I was 21. I'd never been abroad before.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
You spent some time in Prague. This was where this book is set, mm-hmm. very largely. Prague is a really nice place to set such a novel, I think. I feel like in that city particularly, reality feels a little bendy there. Does that how it feel to you?
It is absolutely the definition of uncanny, that place, because there's so much about it that seems familiar, both from home, in the sense that, you know, there's a big Tesco's and then Starbucks, all this familiar stuff. It also seems familiar because it is the beautiful bohemian Gothic that we've seen in films and on postcards. But also when you arrive, it's totally strange, and it has a stage set quality. You think nothing's this beautiful, this is ridiculous. And in the old town square in particular, and I put this line in the book because it struck me so much. All these facades all around you, one after the other, of these beautiful but also very different buildings, they look like someone could pull a rope and the whole thing would kind of fall down.
Yeah, that's right. It's
quite amazing, isn't it? But then at the same time, 20th century and indeed earlier history is very, very present. So, you know, being able to go to the cathedral where the men who assassinated Heydrich were holed up, and you can still see the bullet marks in the walls from the siege there. And you have the Stolpersteine, the stumbling stones, where there's little brass plaques marking the names of people who were taken from their houses to Terezin and then on to Auschwitz. So it has this extraordinary ability to keep wrong-footing you.
There's a plaque out the front of the Radio Prague building, Czechoslovak Radio building, and it lists all the names of the people who were shot by Soviet soldiers after the Soviet invasion of 1968. Yeah. Everywhere you go in that impossibly beautiful city, there's all this blood and horror.
Yeah.
And it won't let you forget it either.
No, that's right. And there's also Jan Hus in the old town square, the great Reformation martyr, who obviously I'd heard about from years back because my parents were so sort of keen on keeping us up to date on Protestant history. And then not far from that is Jan Palach, the student who burnt himself alive in, I think, 1968, 69.
Yeah, January 69.
And so the two Jans that burnt to death in everywhere you look, there's something very beautiful and very timeless and very eerie, and something very bloody and very distressing, and something very urgent and very contemporary. So it's an extraordinary place.
I've just spent 2 months there on this writer's fellowship, and I know you had the same thing.
Yes.
And it's the same time of year in Prague in the winter yeah. period. Did you spend a lot of time alone there? Mm. And how did that affect you, being alone a lot and writing?
I really enjoyed it. I didn't do any writing, really. I did. So I'd had the idea for Melmoth. I knew it was going to be set in Prague. Fully intended to write 20,000 words while I was there. But actually what I needed to do was just walk around. So almost every morning I walked over Charles Bridge and round in a loop and back, and fed the jackdaws on Charles Bridge. And in the end, the jackdaws came to recognise me, and they would see me in my long camel-coloured coat, and they would turn up for their bacon biscuits. Walked up and down the Vltava, did all the thing, took the little boats out on the Vltava, and really, really enjoyed being alone. And then every now and then someone would come and visit, and I would strut about showing them everything as if I'd sort of made Prague myself for their own amusement.
So. Did you do that thing where you drank a little bit too much one night and what came home wandering through the old town in a state of slight inebriation
where
there's no one on the streets and suddenly you actually do feel like a golem might be around the corner?
Yeah, yeah. I think a friend came to visit and we went to a karaoke bar, and I remember stumbling home from that thinking anything could come round the corner, anything at all. I became a little bit obsessed with opera as well. My flat was right next to the National Theatre, one of the main opera houses. I saw 10 operas in 8 weeks, almost always totally alone. I always put on a very beautiful dress and sat in the box at the opera on my own and listened to the music. It was amazing.
It was while you were in Prague that you started to become ill. What were the first signs that all was not well?
It was a very, very strange illness. I began to have chronic pain in my legs, which made walking through the snow quite difficult. My heart began to race. My head began to hurt. I began to be hot all the time. And it was a sort of system failure. And it's very difficult when your whole body starts to let you down to pinpoint the moment when you think this isn't right. So everyone said, oh, you're stressed. You got a book coming out, you know, you got stress headaches, it's fine. And then I came home and then I began to develop the jitters, which was very, very odd. So I would be standing minding my own business, and then out of the blue, my hands would claw and go rigid, and I would jitter up and down as if gripped by a terrible anxiety about something.
Did you think you were having a nervous breakdown?
I don't think I did. I think other people thought I was, and I knew that I wasn't, partly because I don't...
And they thought you were kidding yourself,
yeah,
I suppose,
yeah.
too.
They were like, oh, you're very anxious. And I thought, no. I am a woman of concrete sanity, and I am not having a nervous breakdown just because I have a novel coming out. And then eventually I began every morning to be woken out of my sleep by a punishing headache, and I don't get headaches. And also, you're never woken by a headache. You wake up and then you get a headache. But to be woken out of sleep by head pain was very strange. And I went to the doctor and they found I had Graves' disease, which is an incurable autoimmune condition that affects your thyroid, which affects your entire body. So,
what are the more extreme symptoms of something like Graves' disease?
Well, the one that's most dangerous is your heart. So you have a racing heart, if it's untreated, it can damage the heart muscle and can give you heart problems for the rest of your life. I also had Graves' eye disease, so my eyes swelled and sort of bulged a little bit. But I was very, very lucky. I was medicated and went into remission pretty quickly. But I suffered muscle wastage. So it wastes your muscles and weakens your bones. And because of that, I ruptured a disc in my spine very, very severely, which led to months of pain and spinal surgery and so on. So it was a little bit like a domino effect. The Graves' disease was the first domino in a chain.
When you get a bad spinal injury, sometimes the effect of that is to not feel, you don't feel like yourself. You feel a little bit out of your own body. It's a very strange thing. Did you have that?
I endured such pain that the only way I could deal with it was by dissociation. So it didn't happen a lot. I was on extremely, extremely heavy medication, 8 different types of medication. So I was out of it literally. But there were a couple of days where, despite the medication, the pain was so savage that I lifted out of my own body and stood in the corner and looked down at myself and thought, come on now, you know, pull yourself together, love. Nothing's that bad. Shush, stop screaming. This is ridiculous. And it's the only time I've ever had this kind of dividing of the consciousness. And it was absolutely depersonalization and dissociation. I could no longer live fully in a body that was putting me through that much pain. So I just left. It was extraordinary.
Was there anyone to look after you?
Yeah, my husband, he had to leave work to be my carer. So he was quite extraordinary. We still have a book, which I can't look at because I find it too distressing. But he kept a little leather-bound notebook of all my medication and the exact time to the minute when each dose was given out. Because, you know, it could have been quite easy to take a very dangerous overdose with the medication that I was on. So, yeah.
You say you're post-religious, but did your religious upbringing in some way sort of affect the way you saw what you were going through? Did you look for some meaning in the suffering?
I don't think it. I mean, it must have affected it because it affects everything. I know that I never said or thought, why me? Because why not me? And I think that partly that was a religious upbringing thing. Partly this belief that, you know, one is not singled out to be a great sinner or to suffer particularly and to learn from something, but rather that we're all called or damned in various ways to various things.
So there's no moral meaning in your mind at the time about the pain you're suffering?
Not really, not any more than there'd be moral meaning in anything else. So I know that sounds... It's in a way I'm almost disappointed, but I also think that I was in such a state that intellectualising it would have been quite impossible anyway. And then looking back, I've never sort of thought along those lines. What I did do was a supernatural thing, which is very different, which is that I thought I was being punished for the success of the Essex Serpent. And not by God. I didn't think it was a religious thing. It was as if the karmic scales had been tipped so far that I had been given pain to compensate.
Wow.
I know.
So, all right. But there's a God there. There's some kind of malicious or some God or Hindu goddess
fates.
Or something.
It felt as if the success of the Essex Serpent, which had been unsought, unexpected, unlooked for, and quite difficult to get my head round, had angered the gods, as in the furies, you know? I felt like I was being punished for hubris, even though I hadn't intended to do, you know, to write a book that had received so much attention. So it felt a little bit like I was being pursued by the Furies.
We're laughing at this now, and that's good because you weren't.
Yeah, no, it wasn't funny at the time.
That's all gone now, though, is it entirely?
Yeah, yeah.
You don't really believe.
No,
there's not
no.
a part of you that thinks that you don't. You didn't quite deserve all that good fortune.
Oh no, I definitely didn't deserve it. No, nobody that year.
Well, then does that mean you deserve the pain?
No,
there's no deserve about it, is there?
No, I don't think so. No. No, it's one of those strange little moments of lack of logic that has really stuck. And of course, I don't think that the fates punished me for my hubris, but also I absolutely do think that.
Did you do writing under the heavy medication you had?
Yeah, I wrote Melmoth.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So you wrote that while you were in agony?
It's an opium novel, yeah.
Wow, really?
I have to stress that was a first draft and partly written under the influence, partly written before the pain, written while I was coming out of the pain. And then there had to be a very rigorous and literally sober process of editing because there were passages in the original draft written when I was suffering and high, which could not possibly have made it to the printer. So, for example, there was a three A4 side description of a policeman being burnt alive in the streets. And looking back now, I would never commit to paper an extended description of a terrible burn and suffering. Never. But at the time, that had seemed a perfectly kind of reasonable and natural thing to do.
Here's magical thinking once again. You told me you set out to write a gothic novel, an opium novel, and then you needed opium, and then you wrote the book. I mean...
Well,
so be careful what you wish for sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I never intended to write an opium novel, certainly. I've always been a real... This is the really interesting thing about having been administered addictive medication and sort of transcendent medication for a long time, and I had to be weaned off them carefully, like a drug addict. Over the course of several months, my dosage had to be very carefully titrated off. You can't just stop tramadol, diazepam, codeine, all of the other stuff, gabapentin, amitriptyline, all of this stuff. But I'd always been rigorously anti-drugs and a little bit priggish and contemptuous about it. I could never understand how glamour attached itself to that kind of thing. And, you know, I loved Coleridge, but that was, you know, that was despite the laudanum use, not because I thought that was cool. And so to find myself part of that company of kind of addled writers was quite extraordinary. And I then began to research it and went back to those writers that we think of as being the opium poets and discovered that they'd suffered terrible pain. Kurt Cobain, for example, had a twisted bowel. I think it was a twisted bowel. Terrible, terrible stomach pain. That's why he ended up taking the drugs that he did. Coleridge had recurrent eye infections and a gammy knee. So he took Kendall Black Drop, became a drug addict. So very often we think of this as being a body of literature that is an opium body of literature, and it's not. It's pain literature.
Lest anyone think I'm talking to a woman who's hollow-eyed and with a erect frame and all that, I should add that you look extremely well.
Thank you.
And despite having a major... You look like you could kick a footy across an oval without too much trouble.
Yeah, no.
How did you get better?
A long process. Luck, I think. A very good spinal surgeon. Very, very good. It's quite a risky operation that I had. I've met people who had the same operation as me and they've had paralysis afterwards because you can nick the spine, the nerve in the spine.
So the pain was that bad, you were ready to risk that?
Yeah. The woman I know who's paralysed, I know her sister, she would rather be paralysed than live with that pain. That's how severe it is. You have no choice. It had reached the stage where you just have to have the operation. All operations carry risks, and I just didn't care. I was beyond caring. And I've, you know, a slow process of pulling myself together. I gave up, I think, felt very old and very ill, and then decided to put on a pair of boots and walk. And I have walked my way back to being quite bonny again.
So. Was there a moment when you felt well, where you felt, this is my old self back again?
I climbed Mam Tor in
what is that?
March. It's a very nice small hill in the Peak District called Mam Tor. Looks like a breast. It's very famous for looking like a breast. And in January of this year, I really thought that I would never do any significant walking again. So I was just exhausted. I was just exhausted all the time. Weak, achy, exhausted. My back hurt. And I decided to pull myself together and start gradually building up my walking until about 3 months after that, my husband said, okay, we'll drive down to the Peak District, find a hill, see if you can get up it. And I got up and I got back down and I ate pie and chips. And that was the moment when I thought I'm not broken anymore. And it was amazing.
How different are you after this experience of terrible illness and intense pain?
Nobody believes me when I say this because I'm very smiley. I feel that the woman who wrote The Essex Serpent no longer exists. I look back at the time of writing The Essex Serpent and see a very young, optimistic and happy person who had never been massively disappointed in sort of the behaviour of others or herself or her body, never really been let down in significant ways. And since then, I've learnt to slightly mistrust everything. Because once you have encountered the total failure of your body in one way or the other, and people have suffered far worse pain and sickness than me, you know, Graves' disease isn't going to kill me unless Brexit means I can't get my medication anymore, in which case I might have a heart attack, but, you know, that probably won't happen.
Oh, my God.
But now, you know, I'm 40 this year. I'm approaching middle age. I'm older and wiser and more patient and a bit sadder, a little bit less optimistic about things. But I don't I don't regret that. I think all wisdom, however you accumulate it, is beneficial. And I'm much nicer to people who are in pain. I have a kind of terrible pity now for pain in other people that can sometimes be quite hard to manage, because I have to make sure that I'm not intruding on their pain by getting upset about mine. But I would be somebody who was very impatient if I was trying to get cash out of a cash point and someone was fumbling with their card in front of me, and I would jostle up and down. And now I think, you know, maybe they're in pain, maybe they're tired, and I just, you know, don't mind. So it's definitely made me a little bit nicer, I think.
If there's one word that recurs more than any other in your book, it's the word look. The narrator is saying, look, look over here, look, look. She's always tugging on our coat throughout the whole book. Look, look at this. This is a book about bearing witness. How much do you really want us to do with all that? There's a theory that I'm a big John le Carré fan, and George Smiley, I think, at one point says, it's his suspicion that all of us only have so much compassion in us, that we only have a quantum of compassion in us. I think that's le Carré anyway. And that gets exhausted. It's not ever growing. It's not like love. Love can grow and grow, but compassion, that you get a little bottle of that, and if you use it all up, then you have to wait a long while for it to refill. What do you think of that theory?
I've thought about this a lot, and about the idea of compassion fatigue, and at what point that you stop kind of feeling that. And I've experienced it myself, but I sort of disagree in the sense that I think that you can find another bottle if you look hard enough, you know, and I think it can run out. But something happened to me last year, which is that I was very, very lucky to be the writer in residence at the Savoy Hotel in London for a month.
Wow.
I know. I get really
That's
good
a thing.
Gigs. It was, I know, it was amazing. So I lived in the Savoy during book tour. Yeah, I had a butler.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really good.
Hang on. You had a butler?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, what was his name?
I had two or three, and I must be jet lagged because I cannot remember the main one's
name. Wasn't Jeeves
or
Jarvis
amazing.
Or
no,
anything
no,
like
he was
that.
From
right.
Goa, and he was so extraordinary. My husband coughed slightly in front of him, and he said, "Oh dear me, dear, 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 dear. No, I will prepare you some tea." And he was gone for about 10 minutes, and he went downstairs and he came back with a silver tray covered in a cloth with a pot and some pots of herbs and a silver teapot, and he very carefully comprised this lemongrass tea with honey and poured it for my husband and made him drink it. And then thereafter, every time he saw me, he said, "How is Mr. Perry's throat?"
Wow.
So I was like, yeah, he's much better.
That's a long way from the Philippines, isn't it?
Oh, it was amazing. I would come home from the airport exhausted after an event in New York or something, having flown back, and arrive at 1 o'clock, and the cab would draw up outside the Savoy, and these handsome doormen in their top hats and coats would say, "Oh, Miss Perry," and they'd open and say, "You look tired. Don't you worry. We'll send your bags up for you. We'll have a pot of tea waiting." And then I would go up to my room, and the butler would come in and say, "Oh, you've had a long journey. I've made you some chamomile. And I brought you some cookies." It was amazing. Anyway, whilst all this was happening to me, the homelessness problem in London has reached Dickensian levels because of the government that we have now, and its austerity measures. And I would come out of the Savoy having been treated like a beloved family member who doesn't come and stay often enough, and you're jolly well better spoil her or she's never going to come back. And then I would walk down the Strand and there would be someone in terrible poverty. I mean, people with no shoes. This is London in 2019. Pouring with rain, I passed a young man who had no shoes. I could not walk past them. I physically couldn't do it. So I would end up doing hot chocolate runs and checking on how people were. And it used to take me a very long time to walk up to St. James's Park for my constitutional. And I didn't do it every day, but there were days when I knew that I had to. And so my compassion bottle was refilled by my own privilege, I think. And sometimes maybe that's what we need, rather than constantly confronting people who demand compassion, which can drain us, to think more carefully about our own privilege, which renews our capacity to pass it on. Because if I hadn't been staying at the Savoy, I might have given the odd person a pound into their cup. But because I was there, that made me stop and say, "Good morning. You've got no shoes." And as it happened, this chap, about four people had noticed that he didn't have any shoes. He said, "No, honestly, someone's coming with some trainers, but I'd really like a hot chocolate." I was like, okay. So maybe that's the trick.
Where does freedom lie in all of this? Is there a sense in which you can find yourself, I don't know, imprisoned by that sense of compassion or freed by it?
I would like to think freed. I would like to think that there is a way in which you're forced to trust your better instincts. So one of the things that used to stop me from speaking to homeless people was embarrassment. What do you say? What do you do? I'm not embarrassed to speak to anyone else. What do? I say, morning, how have you been? And what happened was I found myself freed up by accepting that my instinct was to say the same thing to them. And sometimes we're really anxious that our instinct is wrong and that we're going to fail in some way. And I think for most of us, our impulses, when faced with that sort of thing, are sound. And the big thing that I learned was that you just walk past and you say, morning, have you eaten today? And sometimes they'll say, I have actually, but I could do with a bottle of water. Or they'll say, no, I haven't. And then you can say, do you want a sandwich? It's really straightforward. The answer to the problems sometimes are so simple and so human, but we get caught up with, what do I do? What do I say? Do I give them £5? Is it going to go on drugs? What? And then you don't do anything.
Are you still in pain?
Yes, most days.
Today?
Yeah, a little bit.
Where? In your back?
My back, yeah.
And are you able to kind of, how do you manage that? Do you take painkillers for it now, or do you?
Very rarely. I go for a walk. So I'm going to walk down to the harbour and back in my raincoat, and then I'll be fine. So I sort of, occasionally I think to myself, I'm in pain every day. That's a bit of a shame. And then I think, yeah, you're in pain and a walk will help you feel better. You know, that's a very amazing position to be in, isn't it?
Do you think you're a better writer for having travelled out to the extremity of human experience through that pain?
Yes, definitely. I couldn't, both morally, I think, and technically, couldn't have written the bodily trauma that's in Melmoth had I not experienced it. So I also, because I'm very unlucky, had a terrible third degree burn during this period. Had to deal with that. And so
I'm just taking the cup of tea away from you now.
Yeah, I'm not allowed hot water bottles. It's very unfair. I would have felt it morally tricky to write about physical trauma and deep physical pain had I not experienced some of that myself, because it would have felt appropriative and prurient and I wouldn't have been sure I was getting it right. But I now know what it's like to feel pain. I know what it's like to feel humiliated by pain. Pain is a very humiliating thing. It's degrading. It's not noble at all. There's no nobility in it. And I'm hoping that that's made me a better writer.
Sarah, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Dziękuję, nazladano, all those Prague words. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
I spoke with Sarah Perry last year when she was in Australia as a guest of the Sydney Writers' Festival. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.